You're listening to the New City Church podcast. These episodes are recorded live on Gadigal land. Sometimes the audio quality might not be perfect because what you're listening to is a conversation. We don't edit out the chatter. We think that's what makes it authentic. Wherever you're tuning in from, we hope you find this episode encouraging.
For those of you who maybe don't know me, I'm Kiralee and I use she, her pronouns. I love being a part of this church and it's such a gift. When I'm not here at church, how I spend my daily life is I'm a social worker in youth mental health. But I'd also consider myself someone who's, my mind loves to think below the surface of things and to look at the layers of things to make sense and to question. And I'll let you know that both of those things you might notice today in my talk do shape how I ponder and how I explore God, my relationship with the Bible and the world around me. And so, like Sammy said, we are in a really special series at the moment called New Preacher Picks. And so these people have been people who had the absolute privilege last year of doing Aiden's 101 preaching course. And so I will let you guys know it was amazing. Sammy can attest. And I do highly recommend, like, if you want to do it even just for your personal growth or even just to learn more about, like, even how do we explore the Bible and translations and different lenses and things like that, it was truly amazing. So far in this preaching series, we've had the amazing Sammy, who just led us in worship. We had Chris last week, and so I have the privilege now of giving it a go myself. So thank you so much for having me, and I hope we can go on this journey today. So as Christine just read to you, I've chosen a passage that has actually been truly formative for me about how I understand God and how creation was designed to exist together. It has been a significant tool that I've used to ponder over and over again, like a marker that I feel has helped me grow. Now, I don't actually like this saying that church used to have, like, to also keep you in check. So I'm actually going to change that language. And I would say it's a passage that I use to help me stay attuned to God, or as tensionally as I can try to be. And so I am speaking today on the woman caught in adultery. So John chapter 7, verse 53 to 8, verse 11. You've probably heard it spoken about many times. It's often sometimes used quite toxically against the gender of women and focusing on sin and temptation and kind of getting caught up in that. Or maybe you've actually heard it more helpfully spoken as a passage that speaks to Jesus's grace. And so today, what I want to explore with you is what context this passage has in this spot in John, its historical significance, to explore with you then what Jesus could be exampling and trying to communicate about God's kingdom in this passage. I'm actually purposefully going to leave you with questions to ask yourself rather than give you explicit answers. How fun does that sound? Don't worry, I will also leave you with a reflection at the end to sit with that you can maybe help you get to consider for yourself. How does Jesus actually go about teaching us about what God's kingdom is like and how it should change the way we explore wisdom and the decisions we make in regards to justice in our own present day experiences? So let's start with historical context. Like, where are we in Jesus's timeline? So at this time in Israel, Israel is under Roman rule at this time, but the day-to-day authority of governing the local people is given to the Jewish leaders. Okay, and Jesus has already started his ministry traveling around Galilee, teaching, performing miracles around these communities. But these start getting the Jewish leaders upset. So Jesus then travels beyond Galilee, then ministering to other communities, before he then travels back to Jerusalem for the Festival of Tabernacles, which is where John 7 occurs. So what is this Feast of Tabernacles? It's one of Judaism's three major pilgrimage festivals. It's where worshippers would gather together in these temporary shelters, to remember God's provision and protection in the wilderness for those 40 years in the desert. And so they'd be living in these shelters for a week-long celebration that is meant to be marked by joy, marked by welcoming in guests. There would be symbolism of water liberations and light ceremonies carrying this messianic hope for future salvation. And so we'll see Jesus teaches upon this during chapters 7 and 8. However, before we get there, you may notice in your Bible, and as Christine just read for us, a footnote at the very beginning of this passage where it says, this passage is not in all Bibles. So I'm going to take a moment to kind of sit with you because let you know that this passage isn't in the earliest versions of the Gospels that we have, okay? The earliest accounts that we have. But they are present in later accounts of the Gospels, both in Luke and John, but also found in multiple different spots, so both in two different spots in each. The thing is, it's also still considered a historically accurate and true event because it's also present in other early historical documents in the first and third century, which are the same age of the earliest gospel accounts we do have. And it was considered a culturally significant passage for the early church with a really strong oral tradition that it showed up so many times in so many historical documents. So then the question is why in the end has it been chosen to be between John chapter 7 and 8? And funnily enough, there's actually quite a lot of debate about this. Some people are like, yes, it does match John's style and it does focus on grace. And then some people are like, oh no, it doesn't really match. And then it's the same thing of like, it does match the rhythm and tension and what's going on in the community at this time. And then saying, no, it kind of breaks up the flow of the chapter. So there is that debate. But today I am going to speak from the perspective that it does make sense for this story to be placed between chapters John 7 and 8, as it does historically match the tensions between Jesus and the Jewish leaders of the time, where he is retreating from the crowd and coming back to teach due to the threat to his life. But I'm also going to share that it does give significant example to what I believe Jesus is trying to communicate to the Pharisees at this time over the chapters of 7 and 8. So I'm going to give you a quick walkthrough of these chapters and kind of note a few things that we can start noticing that he's trying to communicate to the community at this time before we then dive into our passage. So with John chapter 7 and 8, it's characterized by this tension between Jesus and the religious leaders. Jesus has been in Galilee rather than Judea because the Pharisees have been threatening his life. It starts with Jesus explaining to his disciples that he didn't even want to go to the festival straight away in John 7:7 because the world is up in arms against me. It's against me because I expose the evil behind its pretensions. And so we already see that Jesus' preaching has been flipping tables, pun intended, on the religious system for his life to have been under threat already for some time. And so once Jesus does go to the festival to teach at the temple, he calls out the misuse of Moses' law by the Pharisees as hypocrisy when they are trying to criticize him about his miracles practiced on the Sabbath, when they too work on the Sabbath when practicing circumcision. And so Jesus then says in chapter 7, verse 24, look beneath the surface so you can judge correctly. Again, Jesus seems to be hinting that there is something beneath what's going on that's important that the religious leaders are not recognizing. And so we see Jesus come in and out of the festival as the religious leaders team up against Jesus to arrest him. And when he comes back to the crowd, he then preaches on the focus of the festival, sharing to the crowd, if anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. Rivers of living water will brim and spill out of the depths for anyone who believes in me in this way. And it notes that the crowd listening was split, some believing Jesus in what he says, and some not, there being this sense of confusion, but in all of it, a disbelief of never having heard someone speak this way before. But the Pharisees try again to arrest Jesus and fail, as it's not his time yet. And when these guards don't bring Jesus to the Pharisees, they have this rant, criticizing the crowd as ignorant of God's law to believe such a guy. And so only the leaders are smart enough to know not to believe him. Even though one of them, Nicodemus, calls them into question, asking, does our law decide about a man's guilt without first listening to him and finding out what he's doing? Nicodemus here is highlighting that even the leaders themselves, they're not following the law. They're misusing their authority for their own desires and then declaring it law. Then our passage comes in here after our Pharisees go home from this discussion. And I will speak to our passage, like I said, but after we explore what chapter 8 is like. But I'm going to check in, like, are we seeing this dualism of law and ruling framework on one side and then Jesus and kingdom on another? We see this sense of misuse of power to harm on one side. And then this other side, it's about what's beyond this provision of living water, a full life for anyone. And so chapter 8 continues when Jesus once again comes to the crowd and addressing them again in line with the festival symbolism. He says, I am the light of the world. No one who follows me stumbles around in darkness. And again, the Pharisees don't like this. So Jesus then goes on to explain to them, you decide according to what you can see and touch. I don't make judgments like that. But even if I did, my judgment would be true because I wouldn't make it out of the narrowness of my own experience, but in the largeness of the one who sent me. You're tied down to the mundane. I am in touch with what is beyond your horizons. You live in terms of what you can see and touch. I'm living on other terms. I told you that you were missing God in all this. You're at a dead end. If you won't believe I am who I say I am, you're at the dead end of sins. You're missing God in your lives. Jesus keeps repeating to them that they only perceive from what they can see and touch, from what they've known, which is not God who sent him, that Jesus and therefore God sees something beyond these religious constructed rules and framework. Jesus continues explaining that living in this way, in the narrow-mindedness of a system that is flawed and harmful, is like being trapped. He speaks with them about they are descendants of Abraham, that Abraham wouldn't be doing what they are by trying to kill him, and that what they are doing instead is just trying to repeat and trying to maintain what was done before them without actually knowing the why behind. And so I'm also going to pause and take a note here that with all of this discussion going on between Jesus and the Pharisees and the dualism that we see, we could apply a sociological and structural perspective to it. And my take here in that is that Jesus is actually trying to introduce them to socialization. That is, as humans, we learn about the world from the constructions that we came from, that came before us. And as we grow up, that's how we make sense of the world until we are ready and older to explore its meaning for ourselves. Or we don't grow and we don't ever see a world beyond the constructed norms that we've known. And so then coming back to our passage, Jesus continues calling their perspective into light to see what else, if not the Father, characterizes him. So chapter 8, 42, why can't you understand one word I say? Here's why, you can't handle it. You're from your father, the devil, and all you want to do is please him. He was a killer from the very start. He couldn't stand the truth because there wasn't a shred of truth in him. When the liar speaks, he makes it up out of his lies and his lying nature and fills the world with lies. I arrive on the scene and I tell you plain truth, and you refuse to have a thing to do with me. Can any one of you convict me of a single misleading word, a single sinful act? But if I'm telling the truth, why don't you believe me? Anyone on God's side listens gladly to God's word. This is why you're not listening, because you're not on God's side. I think Jesus is establishing that there is a constructed framework of belief, of law, that they are holding as authority. And that is taking priority over the one who inspired these laws, Yahweh, and his relationship with Moses. And now, these constructed guidelines are underlied by lies of power, control, of hierarchy, that actually come up against what kingdom is characterized by: equality and full life based in love for all. And so I'm wondering if you're like me and you see that there is this socialization, that we are born into a society characterized by a set of constructed norms that we are blind to until we are made aware that they are not reality itself, but a lens to perceive it by, that we can look through and also take off to see beyond. And I believe Jesus is actually trying to help them see beyond the law, the difference between empire constructions and kingdom itself. So I'm going to use this as a tool then to explore our passage for today. We're finally getting there. Thank you for the wait. And so our passage, just like it was read out for us, we come back to when Jesus has returned to the festival, returned to the temple from the Mount of Olives, after he retreated again to not get arrested because it wasn't his time. And he starts teaching, and during this time, the Pharisees approach him with a trap. Having caught a woman in adultery and brought her before Jesus to catch him out. Because if he either shows her mercy or condemns her, they can claim that he doesn't know the law. Because the Bible actually says in Deuteronomy 22, verse 22, it clearly states that both the man and the woman must die for adultery. And so what the Pharisees are doing at the moment, they are aware that what they are doing is against the law. They are illegally harming a woman alone for their own desires. And so I am going to actually put something out there, a personal note, that anyone who uses this passage to shame women didn't look any further into the Bible than their own assumptions or preconceived biases against women. I'm not going to speak any more on that, but I think the Bible does speak really clearly there. And so the thing is actually what Jesus does, he doesn't even engage on their level. He doesn't debate with them. He doesn't even call out their misuse of the law at this time. He does something different. He challenges them. Let one who is sinless be the first to cast the stone. He's asking them to become self-aware and reflect using their own ability to analyze with absolute honesty, then make the decision for themselves how to engage in this judgment and this violence. Jesus has asked them to critically think based on their humanity, their past and present, and see themselves as the wielder of this punishment, of treatment that they, in line with these thinkings, may even deserve themselves. And so we're going to pause here again, and we start seeing Jesus differing from empire's way of acknowledging sin. Not by predetermined, constructive frameworks of ideas of how things should be, based on rules that do have limitations and power structures that can clearly be misused. Rather, he brings justice's determination into the present moment with all the people in that space being involved.
by equalizing the authority to punish to be based on humans, and the ability to be sinless and undeserving of the same treatment. Jesus shows that kingdom doesn't even engage in the paradigms of segregating people based on a system of hierarchy to make these decisions for the community. He goes straight to acknowledging and engaging with individuals on a personal level of the rightness of actions based in equality of the human experience. And by this, he's presenting a new way of determining justice that is based on equality, authenticity, integrity, and wisdom. And I'm going to pause for one moment, and actually I think that is the reason why for the early church that this was such an important, culturally significant passage for them to go to, because when we think about the early church, they had just lost the law, the old covenant, the old way of determining justice that had been changed. And this interaction actually gives them the example of what to do, of how to do this new covenant in their daily lives. And I think that is why it must be so significant to our early church and why it popped up so many times. But also acknowledging for humans, though, in general, like when we first hear that human-constructed frameworks have limits and may not be the best at determining justice, like as human beings with nervous systems, like that can be scary, like that can cause panic, because that's all we've known. Like it feels safe to have this clear-cut order to go off. Do this, do that. It gives us a sense of control. But I think Jesus shows us that this isn't safe, that we actually lose control rather than gain it. For it can be misused, being based on power or preconceived ideas about people that do segregate, which in turn is unequal, and it does cause harm. And he shows with his way that no one could actually argue with equality and wisdom being the basis for justice, as no stone was cast. Jesus was the only one that could judge under this framework. And he showed the kingdom doesn't respond to sin with punishment. He shows that Yahweh's kingdom has a different way of understanding how to treat sin. The Hebrew word for sin is a bow and arrow term for missing the mark, meaning error or unintentional failure. Not this inherent evil of the flesh that we can sometimes hear being described by some Christian doctrines. How empire treats missing the mark is judgment based on predetermined rules to determine the punishment. And Jesus shows kingdom doesn't focus on the sin itself, but how it impacts the lives of people by saying, go and leave the life of sin. I have two thoughts on this. One, Jesus cares more about the woman's life and its quality, its freedom, without being a slave to a life that breeds sin, missing the mark, and the harm it does to her herself. And two, he also cares about the impact the system of judgment and punishment has on the accusers, by preventing them from becoming violent perpetrators of abuse and harm that does to their own well-being in turn. He gave them another way than being the one to cast a stone to harm and kill another human being and what that would do to them. I believe Jesus gets that this can be a loop of harm begets harm, being socialized into a system that in and of itself is missing the mark, breeds harm to all within that system in society. And so Jesus' actions here uphold the well-being of all involved. He doesn't say that sin's okay, but I think he sees it in its entirety across the interplay between people and society and the deep impact that has on personal well-being. He actually has a whole different approach that says kingdom freedom and life can be available here and now if we step out of this loop of harm, of living under a social system that is characterized by missing the mark and casting a stone that ultimately is at ourselves and the other. And so in saying this, I'm not villainizing societies and I'm not villainizing frameworks of order, but just admitting that they are constructed and they do have limitations, and we can be invited to engage with them mindfully to remember that there is a world beyond them. And so in summary, in real time, I think Jesus here examples a different way than empire and law to live. Just as he was trying to communicate across the John in chapters 7 and 8, where they could not see beyond what they could see and touch or hear something different through Jesus' words. So I believe Jesus showed them through action that holding the Mosaic law or any socially constructed law as authority was confining their thoughts and worldview to be based on power, control, and us and them dynamics that was causing harm. Jesus examples a new order, a new covenant that's marked by love, equality, justice, and mercy. And I don't believe this new covenant is meant to be solely based on blind trust in Jesus' death and resurrection, that no sex before marriage and then you're in. I don't believe that's the life he's actually exampling here. I believe he actually shows us that kingdom, this heaven as life with God, can be presently experienced on earth through learning how to love more and harm less one interaction at a time. Because when we have those moments when love and true connection truly happen rather than harm or disconnect, that is truly wondrous, and I feel like it's a touch of heaven. And so he shows us how to do that, how to actually live and determine this in the present moment, through practicing self-awareness, critical thinking, and honest accountability to the equality of humanity. It's constant relational work with ourselves, others, and God to live this life. I do want to take a moment to acknowledge that we can put any human-constructed, often man-constructed framework or law under the understanding of empire here. And so in doing that, we can do that for ourselves right now and also acknowledge where we find ourselves in the world. At this time, we do have global leaders using law, supposedly Christian or supposedly justice, to harm people. But in return, we have global masses of people uniting across boundaries to say we see humans equally and to call out horror and injustice of the violence being committed by systems and biases of segregation. We are seeing empire versus what I would say is kingdom regard for humanity, whether it is under Christian or not. We see that being played out in such a real and scary way in our world at this moment. And the truth is it's overseas, but it's also at home in Australia, even with what we've just seen in this last week, a few suburbs away from here, where people in power have perpetrated violence illegally in the name of law and called it justice. We are seeing this casting a stone by power systems, and then people of wisdom seeking equality-based justice. We are seeing that play out in the world right now, and that is scary, tense, but it also brings about hope for me to see so many people have this heart for humanity that I do believe is like love and my kingdom. And the other thing is that we can also see empire influence our day-to-day perspectives and decisions. The truth is we are socialized into our societies that often do have their own biases or sets of who's in, out, or different, and a norm of the right and wrong ways to go about this. And that's okay to a point. Like I'm saying, it is a natural process, and I'm not shaming anyone for that. But as we grow up, it's that question of, do we leave it there? And what's the impact of that? And so I do want to leave you, Jesus style, intentionally not giving you explicit answers to that. And I think Jesus does that so often, so intentionally, as not to hinder you or us from our own transformation of doing this work ourselves and this questioning. Jesus got them to do the thinking work themselves in our passage. And I believe that's what brings about the transformation of mind and heart and spirit. And this is actually also proven by science. Our bodies need to go through processing to experience change. And God knows this. I believe he hardwired us this way intentionally, as they want to lead us through learning and growth together in relationship. That's what this existence and kingdom is meant to be about. Deep life together, even, and I think really importantly, during the rest of the day. And so these are the three questions that I want to leave you to reflect on for yourselves. These three questions I have been, like I said, using to attune myself, pondering over and over again, that this passage has helped me ask. One, what do you prioritize as your bias or framework for wisdom? Is it empire or kingdom? Two, what is it to live a life that leans into kingdom wisdom, with self-awareness, critical reflection, and love-based inequality? Three, what's the impact of this on yours and others' well-being? I also shared that I'd end with giving you some reflections of where I've come to this point, asking those three questions myself. And so I'm going to finish by sharing you a poem. I accidentally wrote this poem when I was trying to start writing this sermon, so that's how this came about. It is a poem that is actually a reinterpretation of this passage, with Jesus represented by Sophia. In the Old Testament, Sophia was considered wisdom and Jesus personified. And so I encourage you, settle back. This is a poem. You're welcome to sit, close your eyes, take a deep breath, ground yourself. You can let it maybe settle some of these big things that I know I've just been talking about. And I will share with you that different things would resonate differently for people in this, and I also recognize that there is more to this conversation than is in this poem. But settle in, get comfortable as you would like to. This poem is called Wisdom Looks Into the Mess. Crowded in, people swarming the courtyard, fueled by new damnation. Stone has been placed in our grasp, mob mentality ready to guide our hand, accusations cast with retribution awaiting to be thrown. In righteous anger, the throng is ready to curse and disown. And then wisdom walks into the mess to ask what rights we have to chastise when we too have wronged. Shocked to honesty, knowing our inner shadows, we let stone fall from hand. Reflecting on her critique, who should have power over another when we are equal in our humanness? On ground with no haste, she writes of justice, of harm being acknowledged. But is the only righteous way to do this punishment? Or is justice the hard work of reconciling, of self, or maybe even communal examination, leaning in, becoming intentionally proximate to that which we shame. To not turn away, but to look and see and admit. To offer remorse, respect, or at least name it honestly. With mercy, her other side, the lens that sees the human being behind the behavior, the perception, and assumptions made by systems enmeshed. Mercy knows story lies beyond what the surface level presents. When she holds out her hand, strong and gentle, no blind eye is turned, nor violence swept under the rug, no. Her eyes direct, looking deep. Gaze holding the seriousness of what it is to disrupt harmony. Wisdom knows to make right will be healing for all involved, as harm done to one is harm done to all. For our lens of humanity is constructed collectively. What is shamed, devalued, dehumanized is an injustice we are all desperately fighting against not to be. We are all hardwired to love, but socialized to believe it is finite. I have to pick up this stone, or it may be turned on me. This sounds painful and overwhelming. States of disharmony and constant battle to fit in. But what to do if tired of this? The hurt of it has gone on too long, disconnected too much. Maybe it might start with the next time we are faced with holding stone in hand. To learn to step back and critically think. Remember the equal nature of humanity. Maybe we could take a pause, a breath. Play with the dirt beneath our feet, the earth we all share. Acknowledge that we may not have the answers to make sense of this just yet. So choose in this moment not to cast the stone. Rather, invite wisdom in, justice and mercy close, and see what direction life-giving empathy leads.